You have that option. Truth in advertising, fair warning, all that. Well, we're in John chapter 11 tonight as we continue looking at this early part in our study of the miracles of Jesus, looking at the miracles in the Gospel of John. And we come to the last of the seven miracles that are in the Gospel of John, not counting the resurrection itself. And there's another event after the resurrection that certainly appears to be miraculous, but the seven leading up to the resurrection. And it culminates with this raising of Lazarus from the dead. And this brings us to chapters 11 and 12, which I call here the crucial transition. This is, in a lot of ways, what ties the earlier part, the introduction to the book, with the last week of Jesus' life, his passion, the crucifixion, and so on. And chapters 11 and 12, in a lot of ways, are the link between those two sections. And so this is the climactic miracle of all of the miracles that we've looked at. Now, of course, in reality, it's no more difficult for God to do what is to us an extraordinary miracle or a simple miracle. It's all the same to God. But from our perspective, raising somebody from the dead, in this case, someone that's been dead for 4 days, seems astounding testimony, certainly, to the power of God and so on. And so that kind of caps off this first section of the book and prepares us for the coming real focus of the gospel. All of the gospels are really about the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, and everything else is just introductory material to that. This becomes the ultimate sign of Jesus as the one who gives life. In a lot of ways, that's what all the miracles do. The stilling of a storm that is the threat to life, the feeding of people who are hungry and starving, and how we depend upon food for life, and so on. Well, the ultimate demonstration of the power of God to create, sustain life is in the raising of one from the dead. And also what you would see if we had time to look at John more carefully, the gospel certainly begins in chapter 1 describing Jesus as life and light, and of course particularly associating light with the creation story, let there be light, and that Jesus is the creator of all things, in particular the creator of life. In him was life, and it was the light of men. These same themes are wrapped up again in chapter 12, where all throughout Jesus had been declaring himself to be the light of the world and that type of thing, and called to walk in his light and rather than in the darkness. Another thing that we just want to notice by way of a general observation before we look at the story is that this introduces one of the great paradoxes in the story of Jesus' death and resurrection. Because when Jesus chooses to go give Lazarus life, he is choosing at the same moment death for himself. Notice in chapter 11, verse 53, John puts this statement in here, "So from that day on they planned together to kill him." Now, this is not the first time the authorities have plotted to kill Jesus. But this is the time they plot to kill Jesus, and they're going to succeed, so to speak. And so, in other words, the raising of Lazarus from the dead is the straw that breaks the camel's back. That's the final thing. They just can't stand it anymore. They plot to kill Jesus, and will actually do it this time. And so, of course, Jesus knew this, knew what was going to happen. And so his purposeful intent to go and give life to Lazarus actually will cause his own death. Now, we ought to see some symbolism in that, certainly. And what is that? Charlie? Okay, the way we have life given to us as well is through the death of Jesus. Now, what we are receiving is not physical resurrection in terms of 4 days after we die, we're going to be resurrected, but our physical resurrection is part of it. But even more importantly is the spiritual resurrection that comes to us. So through Jesus' death comes life for anybody. You know, if anyone's going to have life, it's going to be through the death of Jesus. Now, in this case, you know, his death comes afterwards, but it is symbolic of the fact that Jesus' death is the price. And so, through his death, he will bestow a true life upon all of us. And you remember this prediction, prophecy that Caiaphas, the high priest, said. You know, the authorities were saying, you know, what are we doing? We're not being very effective in how we're dealing with this Jesus problem. This man's performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everybody will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. And by place, they mean the temple. They're going to destroy the temple, and they will destroy our nation. And Caiaphas says, you know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people and that the whole nation should not perish. And he even makes their observation, he didn't say this of his own initiative, but being high priest, he prophesied Jesus was going to die for the nation and not for the nation only, but that he might also gather together into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. Now, I really doubt that Caiaphas intentionally was saying, oh, Jesus is the Messiah whose vicarious death will bring spiritual salvation to us. He's the fulfillment of Isaiah 53 and all that. He surely meant by this, you know, it's better to bump this one troublemaker off and avoid trouble with the Romans, and our nation will be spared. So it's his way of saying we need to kill Jesus. But John sees it, of course, a much more profound meaning. There's a deeper truth to it than what Caiaphas even intends. So it's an unwitting kind of prophecy, I guess you might say. I guess you could raise the same question, did Balaam's donkey really know what he was saying when God caused him to speak? You know, don't know. We certainly know that many of the prophets who spoke didn't fully understand what they were saying. You know, Peter tells us they desired to look into these things. So it is true that God has used spokespersons to reveal his will and say things, and they didn't fully understand the true significance of it. And so that's evidently the case here with Caiaphas as well. But what it does speak to, the truer fulfillment, the deeper meaning of this, is that through Jesus' death, salvation, true life will come to the whole nation. And also, at the end of chapter 12, you see this statement as well. You know, the final words of Jesus here that kind of wrap all of this up and prepare us for the beginning of his crucifixion. In chapter 12, at the end, verse 44, he who trusts in me does not trust in me, but in him who sent me. He who beholds me beholds the one who sent me. I have come as light into the world, that everyone who trusts in me may not remain in darkness. And if anyone hears my sayings and does not keep them, I do not condemn him. For I did not come to condemn the world, but to save the world. He who rejects me and does not receive my sayings has one who condemns him. The word I spoke is what will condemn him at the last day. For I did not speak of my own initiative, but the Father himself who sent me has given me commandment what to say and what to speak. And I know that his commandment is eternal life. And therefore the words I speak just as the Father has told me. And so the paradox is Jesus brings words of life to save the world. That was his purpose for coming. But the paradox is the result of his coming is going to be judgment, condemnation, because they reject the words of life. And if you reject life, what do you get? The only other option is death. And so Jesus does become this light that shines on every man, but some love the darkness and scurry for the darkness, and some love the light and will come to the light. And this miracle is a kind of a parable in action demonstrating that very thing, as you see the two totally different ways people react to this particular miracle. Comments or observations, questions of a general Devin?
According to chapter 12, verse 10, Jesus wasn't the only one they were going to plot to kill.
Right, right.
They were plotting to kill Lazarus as well. And that reminds me of what was said, and I'll paraphrase it, they do the righteous will suffer persecution.
Right. Yeah, it's not enough to kill Jesus. Let's bump off Lazarus, which, you know, raises an interesting question. You know, Lazarus was dead once, and he didn't stay dead. What makes them think, well, this time we'll make sure, pulverize him in little pieces or burn him or what? I don't know. But it's the same old thing. Get rid of the, anything that's going to remind you or prick your mind. You know, it's their guilty conscience that is what's in the way here, All right, so in the first 16 verses is when the basic story kind of unfolds. We're told that Lazarus, this good friend of Jesus, is sick. Verse 3, the sisters therefore sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. So they've apparently sent, a servant, a messenger, somebody to come to Jesus. They didn't come themselves, and they relayed this message. And we're not told anything more than that. No request, come quickly and heal him before he dies, something like that. I do think we're probably to understand his sickness was serious. We talk about sickness as if it's just kind of a, I stubbed my toe, I've got a cold. When they talked about being sick, they meant something that was life-threatening, And that was clearly the case here. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified by it. And it kind of reminds you of what was said about the blind man. The disciples said, why was this man born blind? Did he sin or did his parents sin? And Jesus said, well, neither one, but that the glory of God might be seen in him through what Jesus was going to do with this case. Now, if you think about some connections with what's been going on previously, when we get down to verse 37, and Jesus is standing there at the tomb of Lazarus, and of course Lazarus is still dead at this point. Notice in verse 37, they said, could not this man who opened the eyes of him who was blind have kept this man also from dying? Now, in the story of John, the only blind man Jesus has healed is the guy in chapter 9. And so that appears, again, to be still on their mind. Some of them are aware that here's a man who was born blind that Jesus was able to cure. Boy, if he could do that, don't you think he could have, if he had been there in the nick of time, he could have kept Lazarus from dying? But, of course, it doesn't even enter their mind that Jesus could raise him from the dead after he's died. Once he's died, well, that's it. Jesus had gotten there 10 minutes sooner. He could have done something, but there's no expectation Jesus is going to raise him from the dead. Also, this intent of people to stone Jesus. As we said, there were previous plottings by the Jews to stone Jesus. Chapter 10, verse 31, the Jews took up stones again to stone him. And Jesus said, well, which sin are you stoning me? Or which good work that I do that you think's a sin are you stoning me? Well, because you're a blasphemer, And of course, when Jesus says, let's go to Judea, the disciples say in verse 8, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you. And are you going there again? Are you out of your mind? To go back there right into the danger zone. And so you see, there's a lot of connections here between this story and earlier stories. Jesus says in verses 9 and 10, are there not 12 hours in a day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. And again, that's may in some ways seem rather odd, kind of sticking out there. But it's very similar to what he said again in the story of the blind man in chapter 9 and verse 4. And Jesus is basically saying, I've got to act while I'm here to do the work of being the light. And he's not going to allow threats or the fear of death or something like that to deter him from that. And we've seen this theme of Jesus as the light again many times throughout the story. That just illustrates how well put together the gospel is. But one particular question that will come up here, Jesus has said this sickness will not end in death. It's not unto death. and yet Lazarus dies. So, did Jesus lie? That's the first question. Anyone want to say yes, Jesus lied? Jesus was mistaken? You know, Jesus took his best guess. He diagnosed from a distance and turned out to be wrong. Okay. So looking longer term, you know, death is not the final outcome here. It is a doorway to something beyond that. And so clearly, of course, we are the informed readers. We know even before we start reading the gospel, Jesus is none other than the Creator who's taken on human form and done all of these things. And so we read that knowingly, well, of course, it's going to end in life, you know, and even though Lazarus is going to die again at some point, he will be physically resurrected along with the rest of us and the true end of all of us. I mean, Jesus could say to all of us, this will not end in death. That's not going to be the final outcome. We will all be resurrected. But now put yourself in the shoes of the sisters. You know, Jesus said this presumably to the messengers, and they've come back, and Martha and Mary be like, well, what did he say? You know, well, he said this sickness will not be unto death. And then their brother dies, you know. I mean, that would seem like a very difficult thing to handle, you know. So what do we make of that? Jay?
It reminds me of Abraham and Isaac.
Okay. All right. That's right. He promised great things that happened through Isaac. And so God's going to keep his promise. And Hebrew writer tells us Abraham had just assumed on his own part that somehow God was going to resurrect Isaac. And that's kind of funny in that case, because Abraham does think of resurrection as the solution, when in fact God keeps Isaac from dying in that case. By intervening. And so where is your confidence lie, you know? And I really think we can relate to this because, you know, God has not certainly explained his plan to all of us in great detail. You know, it wasn't like Jesus said, you go tell the sisters that I'm going to come, I'm going to let Lazarus die, but I'm going to come a little bit later and raise him from the dead, and this will be better for the kingdom and getting the message out and all that. And I mean, what sister wouldn't say, well, okay, you know, that's we can live with that, you know, that'll be fine. But yeah, he doesn't explain all that to them. In fact, he says something that might very well be thought of as misleading. And you think about that. Here we are reading the scriptures, and we think we understand what they're saying and how to apply them and making application to some particular situations that maybe the Bible isn't addressing directly, but we're drawing some conclusions. And then we find out, well, maybe it was wrong, you know. Things happen all the time in your life, and you think, you know, the Lord's heading in this direction. This is the Lord's intention. You know, the Lord's given me this baby, this new life to raise and nurture and care and raise up to serve him. And then, you know, 2 months old and he dies. And you're like, I don't understand. You know, why did the Lord give me this baby just turn around 2 months later and take this baby away from me? You know, it's very heart-wrenching, you know. And we have to be like these sisters and simply understand we're not God. We don't have all the answers. It's not all explained to us. And ultimately, like Jay said, you just have to trust God, like Abraham did. I know God. So I don't know what God's doing, but I know God. And that's enough, that he acts out of his compassion. He acts out of his wisdom. If it were merely a question of his power, there's no doubt what he can do and would do. But it's a question of the wisdom. You know, what's best? And not just what's best for me, but what's best for all the billions of people that are on the planet and even future unborn generations. And so it is an extraordinary test of faith for Mary and Martha in particular, and maybe even Lazarus as well, you know. I mean, I've often pondered, of course, this is pure speculation, but, you know, if God knew he was going to bring Lazarus back, does Lazarus actually go all the way to the very presence of God, you know, because it would seem to me cruel to drag him away from that, you know, kicking and screaming, y'all, you're going back to earth. No, I don't want to. So I like to think he was just kind of put in a little, you know, foyer or something, a little set there a while, and, you know, time passed very quickly. Again, I don't know, but I certainly think if I was in the very presence of God, I wouldn't want to go back to earth and risk losing it all again by just sinning more or something like that. As much as I'd love my sisters and want to see them and all that, they'll be fine without me, you know. And that explains, of course, why Jesus delays. We are told specifically the reason he delayed was because he loved them. Notice verse 5, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Now, you might just assume that. They were good friends and all that. But John wants to be sure and spell it out for us. Jesus loved these people. So whatever happens, you need to know that it's a function of God's love, not in spite of his love. And notice verse 6, therefore, because he loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus, therefore, when he heard he was sick, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. And this guarantees that Jesus is not going to be there when Lazarus dies. So he intentionally delays and intentionally allows Lazarus to die, and he knows what he's going to do. And a little bit later, he will say, you know, he's glad that he was not there. Verse 11, you know, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go that I may awaken him out of sleep. And the disciples say, well, if he's just fallen asleep, that's great. He'll get better, you know. And so Jesus, of course, was talking about his death. And so he says plainly, Lazarus is dead. He has to spell it out for them. And I'm glad for your sakes I was not there, so that you may believe, and let us go to him. And so Jesus is clearly saying something's going to come out of this that's going to benefit and help the disciples. And had he been there and merely cured Lazarus, then the greater lesson the disciples need to learn, and others as well, would not have taken place. And so God has a greater purpose many times than what we are aware of, and we need to realize that. And so it's just like the first sign, the changing of the water to wine at Cana, where we are told in chapter 2, verse 11, that because of this sign, the disciples believed in Jesus and God was glorified. And that's the same thing that's going to happen here. It'll lead to faith on the part of the disciples, and God is going to be glorified. So how close is Bethany to the danger zone? Well, it's about 2 miles away from Jerusalem. So it's right in the thick of things in terms of exposing Jesus to that threat the disciples were so worried about. Now you understand why. I mean, 2 miles is nothing. Word's going to get around where Jesus is. They could probably throw the stones from Jerusalem to Bethany and get him, you know, if they want to stone him. And then, of course, I have to throw this in, doubting Thomas. He says in verse 16, let us also go that we may die with him. So very noble, very courageous Thomas here. Well, I really doubt that is probably the best way to read this. Seems more the kind of resignation of a desperate person. Well, let's just all go die and get it over with, you know, because that's what's going to happen, you know. This lack of confidence on the part of the disciples about what's really going on here. And finally, just the fact that Lazarus has been buried for 4 days and probably was buried right away as soon as he died is just indicative of the degree to which he's really dead, you know, is the kind of thing. Well, I got some pictures here. This is the traditional location of the burial place of Lazarus in Bethany. You go down these little steps and opens to a chamber and goes down further to a burial chamber down in here. Whether this is really the place or not, of course, nobody really knows. But fortunately, there was an artist to draw the picture. No, okay. Now, the question comes up, of course, what did Martha expect from Jesus? And what did Mary expect? Because they both pretty much say the same thing, word for word. And, of course, you know the story of verse 21. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. They're absolutely confident that if he had been there, he could have spared it. Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. And what does she mean by this? Is this just the kind of thing you say to Jesus? You know, I have trust in you. You have the power to do all things, but not really expecting that he will. And if you think that's extraordinary, just look at, I don't know about you, but I know certainly looking at myself and the way I think about God and the way I pray, I pay lip service to the fact that God is able to do anything. But the reality is, my expectations of God can be quite low at times. You know, and so I'm saying the right thing, but I don't really believe he maybe can do all things. I don't know. I doubt he will. I know he doesn't do all things. And so just where is my expectation? Just how strongly do I believe? You know, we may be praying for something very fervently. And we know God could do it, but do we really believe that he will? And I'm not saying this by way of criticism. I think it's just the limitations of our human existence. I mean, you remember in Acts chapter 12, the disciples got together and they were praying fervently because Peter, of course, was in prison. He was going to be executed like the next day. And they're fervently praying. And then Peter shows up at the door. They're like, no, that's not Peter, you know. And so at least we can be pretty sure that the one thing they weren't praying for was, Lord, deliver Peter from prison and bring him to our door right now, you know. Maybe they were praying for Peter to face death bravely and, you know, cut his head off with a clean chop or something. But it seemed what happened was extraordinary beyond their imagination. And so it's pretty obvious Martha doesn't expect Jesus is going to raise Lazarus from the dead. Because when he says, well, take the stone away, she didn't start jumping up and down saying, oh, good, this is what I've been waiting for. What's taking you so long, Jesus? You should have come here first thing. No, she's like, oh, man, he's going to stink something terrible because it's been 4 days. So it doesn't appear that that was her expectation. But then Jesus says in verse 23, your brother will rise again. Of course, we know what Jesus means by that. He, in fact, is going to be raised this very day. And she says, I know he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. And then notice Jesus' answer, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? Well, when he says they'll never die, do you take that literally? You know, this life is not unto death, you know. Jeanette, you'll never die because you believe in Jesus, right? You live in Jesus. You're never going to die. Well, if you take that as an absolute statement that, you know, your physical life will never pause, that's not true. But it is just a pause. And ultimately, true death is not what we experience because that has been eliminated by Christ for his people. And so really when he says, I'm the resurrection and the life, he's not talking so much about physical resurrection here as much as he is the spiritual resurrection, life that you can have even if you die physically. The kind of life you will have that death cannot touch. And so it's very similar to his healing or feeding of the 5,000 in chapter 6. And he says, I'm the bread of life. And the healing of the blind man, and he says, I came to give sight to the blind and blind those that are sighted. And now he's raising Lazarus from physical death to teach the lesson that he is the true resurrection and the life. And that's what he has come to truly offer the people of the world. And so Mary comes, and again she says something very similar. If you had been here, my brother would not have died. Well, now this brings us to this statement in verse 33. The New American Standard says, when Jesus therefore saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled. But in fact, this is a word that means get angry. It's an onomatopoetic word. It means snort like a horse, and it makes a sound kind of like a horse snorting. In my classes over at the school, I perform for them to illustrate, but I will preserve my dignity here. And it raises the question, you know, what's Jesus angry about? You know, and it comes up again, verse 38, Jesus therefore again being deeply moved within or angry, came to the tomb. And, of course, this is also the context in which he's weeping. And the Jews say, oh, look how much Jesus loved Lazarus. He's because he's weeping in sympathy and grief for Lazarus. Well, as is often the case in the Gospel of John, when people draw a conclusion, they're wrong, you know. And so I think the one thing we can be sure about is it wasn't because of his love for Lazarus that he was weeping, but rather what he sees, the evidence of sin all around, you know. His grief over the Jews' misunderstanding about who he is and his work, maybe troubled at the thought of his own death, you know, that is brought to mind here. But I think ultimately the thing that would most anger Jesus, of course, is the power of Satan, sin and death. And when Jesus is looking at a prime example of that here, of what's broken about the world and the very thing he's come to fix, that seems to me to be really what is happening here. And so then, of course, Jesus will raise him from the dead. Yeah. Right. And that's, you know, that's, I don't know, we have to nail in on one specific thing, but because there's a lot of elements to it. But I think that's, you know, he sees the carrying on of the Jews and their grieving over death and their, you know, lack of understanding about who he is and things like that. I think that's a certainly very plausible kind of thing going on here. One other thing we might note, when Martha objects that there's going to be this bad smell, in verse 39, Jesus said to her, verse 40, did I not say to you, if you believe, you will see the glory of God? Right? Now, when did Jesus ever say that to her?
Not recorded.
Might not be recorded, right? Could be a way of characterizing what he said in their conversation, I'm the resurrection and the life, i.e., the glory of God, something like that. But okay, so remember all the way back in verse 4, this is the only other place the word glory occurs in the story. So my own preference would like to take it back here. And this would be the statement, presumably, that would be taken back by the messenger and relayed to the sisters. The sickness is not to death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified by it. And if they had relayed that message as Jesus gave it, then in some way Martha had been told, now certainly she didn't even begin to comprehend what it meant, that God was going to be glorified. And didn't I tell you, if you trust what I was saying, the message I relayed and you accepted that, that you would see the glory of God in this. And that's what you're going to see. Stand back and see the glory of God. And he calls Lazarus to come forth and, of course, he comes forth, bound up in his burial clothes, and they have to unwrap him and let him go, and so on. Now, and that is interesting because it illustrates what Jesus had said in chapter 5. You know, the hour is coming when those that are in the tombs will hear his voice, and they will come out to a resurrection of life. And all these same words are used here in the story of Lazarus to illustrate, kind of in a little microcosm, this very thing. The voice of Jesus calling this one from the grave, and he comes forth to a resurrection of life. And that's just a physical demonstration of what's going to happen with the physical resurrection of all of us. It's also a symbol of what happens to us in our spiritual resurrection, as the voice of Jesus through the gospel calls to us and resurrects us from our spiritual death, and so on. Well, we've already talked a little bit about the what happens with the authorities, and they want to kill Lazarus as well as Jesus and so on. Of course, that's more irony there, because their solution causes the very thing they're trying to avoid. If we let this guy run amok, the Romans are going to come and destroy the temple and our nation. So let's kill him. And then because they put Jesus to death, the punishment God metes out against the nation Israel is to send the Romans to destroy the temple and the nation. So it's, again, just like the Tower of Babylon, you know. Oh, we don't want to be scattered. Let's build this tower in this great city so we don't be scattered. And so what happened to them? They got scattered, you know, because of their arrogance against the Lord. Well, boy, we have very little time to talk about the widow of Nain and her son. This is another, there really are very few stories of Jesus raising people from the dead. We're, of course, going to have Jairus' daughter, but we'll save that for the cycle of Matthew stories, Matthew miracles that we'll look at. But one of the other prominent ones is Luke chapter 7 with the widow of Nain. Now, Nain's a town about 6 miles southeast of Nazareth, about 25 miles away from Capernaum. Of course, people were buried rather quickly, just about as soon as possible, and of course would be outside of town. You don't, because it's unclean, you don't want to be making vast areas of your town unclean by dead people being buried there. And in this case, clearly the casket is more like a litter, an open carrying thing, because, you know, the dead person can sit right up and start talking and so on. And it emphasizes, of course, this woman is a widow and the fact that this is her only son, which means this woman is left with nobody to take care of her. She doesn't have a husband to take care of her. She has no son to take care of her. Women just can't go out and get a job at 7-Eleven or McDonald's or something. She's going to be utterly destitute. And so it's bad enough, her grief, that she's lost her husband and she's lost her only child. But now on top of that is the horrible situation it puts her in. And Jesus acts out of compassion for this woman. That's what the text indicates, that he had compassion on her and therefore stopped the procession and raised this boy from the dead. Now, we don't know how old he was, but she was his only, or her only child. And it's another one of those miracles. There's actually several of these in the Bible. There's no emphasis on that somebody had to have faith. You know, you hear that a lot with the miracle workers today. They try to do a healing or something and it doesn't work. Well, you didn't have enough faith. You know, you put the blame on the lack of faith of the recipient. Well, many of the miracles of Jesus are completely independent of whether anybody believed. And that's the case here. This woman didn't ask Jesus to stop and intervene. She didn't look up and say, oh, that's Jesus. This is my lucky day. Jesus happens to be here. I'm going to beg him to raise my child from the dead. She probably thought just another stranger, you know. But Jesus takes the initiative and simply does this. And it's another one of these interesting stories where he, you remember like when he healed the leper and he touches the leper, which would normally make him unclean. But it's kind of, again, the Bible's way of illustrating the power of uncleanness doesn't flow in the direction of Jesus. The power of cleanness flows from Jesus. And in the same way here, Jesus, again, this point isn't made explicitly in the text, but I think the implication is Jesus can touch this casket, which would be unclean because of its connection with the dead body, without contaminating himself, making himself unclean. Now, we could say a lot about this setting in chapter 7 here. A lot of what is said in the next several verses is just like in the Gospel of John, where you get a lot of commentary to help you understand the point of the story. There's also the previous story in verses 1 through 10, where you know this centurion had a servant that was near death, and the Jews say, oh, this guy has been so good to us, and we'd like to intervene on his behalf. And Jesus heals this person from a near-death experience, but Again, to us, that's a little bit different than raising someone from the dead. So now, with this second miracle of Luke chapter 7, it's been ratcheted up a little bit where we actually have Jesus raising this person from the dead. But the theme that really comes up here is this idea of Jesus as a prophet. Because you'll notice the conclusion of the people in verse 16 is that a great prophet has arisen among us. Not just a prophet, a great prophet. Something bigger than just your regular run-of-the-mill prophet. Okay? So that's in chapter 7 and verse 16. Now, what's interesting about this is when Jesus asked his disciples, who do people say that I am? And who do you say that I am? Among all the possible answers people give, some people think he's Elijah. And you'll notice a lot of similarities with Elijah here. That's why I put the picture there. You remember this? Elijah raises the son of this widow woman, of Zarephath, that he had been sent to. And that's been referred to earlier in Luke in chapter 4, in the synagogue at Nazareth, his hometown. And he made that argument. He said, you know, there were a lot of widows, but Elijah was sent to this Gentile widow. And there were a lot of lepers, but Elisha was sent to this Gentile leper. So they got the point clearly there that God cares about Gentiles, and they couldn't stand that. And so this idea of being a great prophet, and it kind of brings to mind the great prophet of old, Elijah. But then you notice the next story, John the Baptist says, he sends a couple of his disciples, he's in jail, are you the coming one that we're expecting? Or should we be looking for somebody else? And of course, John is the one that said, he's greater than I am. And John was thought to be a great prophet. But Jesus has got to be greater even than John, certainly. And notice again in verse 22, the answer that's given. Go and report to John what you've seen and heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And so it's the evidence that he is this one that's greater than a prophet. And, of course, you come a little bit later, you have the story of Jesus at the Pharisee's house. If this man knew there were some kind of prophet, he'd know what kind of woman it was touching him. Well, the joke's on him, because if he knew what creator God this was that was in his presence, he would bow down like a dead man at his feet. So he's greater than a prophet. That's the whole point to all of this. And so one who's greater than Elijah even is present here. Yes, a prophet, but one who's greater than a prophet. Well, we'll have to stop there. Our time is up, unfortunately. But anyway.